hello? Hello? Are you there? And she said, well, we're going to have to think about this interview, and I'll get back to you with our editorial board decision. And so my point is that it's really safe and easy to talk about how important it is for those brave people in the non-industrialized nations to rise up against the oppressors. But suddenly when we talk about doing it here, it's like, whoo, time to take a deep breath. And so when I say I admire them, and when I talk about admiring the members of the Irish resistance, that A, doesn't mean that they're all perfect, and B, doesn't mean that we need to put it in the safety of history or the safety of non-industrialized nations. I want to say one more thing, which is Nat Turner's rebellion, the slave rebellion, which, by the way, there was like 300 slave rebellions between 1800 and 1860, a whole, but maybe it wasn't 300, but there's a bunch of them, 150, a lot of them. And, okay, there was three. Just kidding. There was a lot of them. And one of the things about Nat Turner's rebellion that's really extraordinary and wonderful is that they didn't rape anyone, no one. And that, I think, is really crucial too, that it's absolutely crucial that as we fight back, that we don't, I mean, it's like one of the things that really pisses me off is even during the Capital H Holocaust, there were brothels in the sex slaves in the camps. And for a long time, I thought that those were just used by the guards, but it ends up they were also used to give special benefits to prisoners. And it's like, you know, if you're in a fucking death camp, and now what, you're still going to essentially rape a sex slave, it's like, that's not okay. So when we fight back, you know, I got no problem with killing. Like I said, I got myself a list. But we need to make sure that I think it's important that and in any war, there will be, to use the United States phrase, collateral damage. I'm not talking about that. But here's what I'm trying to say, is that when we build our resistance movement, we should also focus on not perpetuating the patriarchy's atrocities, which doesn't mean we don't fight back, because you can certainly fight a war without rape. But that's the thing, is we need to fight a war. There's already a war going on. We need to fight back.
Hi, Jensen. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you.
Answer what you will. I've got three. They're kind of important. Quick, do what you can. So we're speaking to you from Vancouver, site of the 2010 Olympic Paralympic Games. There's been all kinds of changes happening in our city to do with these Olympics, the sort of intensification of corporate capitalist greed and control. I'm wondering what your thoughts are in terms of how important a focus it is, because a lot of the activists are spending all of their time organizing around this event. And whether...
Okay, can we do these one question at a time?
Okay.
Otherwise, I'll forget.
So, Olympics, is it a good focus for activists to break the spell of the glorification of the system?
Another great question. And I don't feel comfortable answering that question because I'm not there. And if you are called to work against that and then to use that also as a larger podium, then that's great. And if at the same time, that's not what's important to you, but you are instead worried about the collapse of grizzly bear populations because of the collapse of salmon populations, then work on that. You know, I think that that, you know, okay. So I live in Northern California, people there may or may not have heard of the Emerald Triangle. This area is known just a little bit for growing marijuana. And just a little bit. And in California, you can get what are called Prop 215 cards, which are medical marijuana cards. And this is going to have a point, don't worry. And the county where I live, for they had a rule that you could have for your own personal medical use up to 99 plants. And now there are those who thought that 99 plants was excessive. And they wanted to reduce the number of plants that you're allowed. And so the Board of Supervisors, which is county commissioners, I don't know what you have up in BC, if it's county commissioners or Board of Supervisors or what. But anyway, the Board of Supervisors here, which is the ruling body for the county, was going to change the rules and to reduce it to six plants is all you can have. Where's the, there we go, six. And it was pretty f-ing amazing because the Board of Supervisors room was packed. And this was participatory democracy in action because if the Board of Supervisors would have reduced it to six, they would have been killed. This was the entire community turning out to not allow the Board of Supervisors to reduce it to serve the cops and the churches. And so for one glorious evening, Del Norte County had a democracy. This is what democracy is supposed to look like, which is the rabble comes in and says, F you, you're not going to take this away from us. Okay, that's the good news. The bad news is when we have any meeting having anything to do with salmon or stopping off-road vehicles, there's five people show up, and it's the same five people every goddamn time. I wish people loved the salmon as much as they love marijuana. And so my point is that what the hell am I don't know what my point is, but my point is that if people can get riled up about the Olympics, I think that's great. And that's a way to open doors. You know, when I talk to small business owners, I don't talk about salmon because they don't give a shit. I talk about Walmart because Walmart's destroying their livelihood. And so you find a place, you find those wedges. When I talk to college students, a lot of times they don't give a shit about salmon either. So one of the things I talk about sometimes with them is entering the wage economy and how stupid it is that you have to get a job in order to survive. I mean, whose idea was that to come up with? That's a terrible idea. And that really speaks to a lot of college students. And so my point is find a wedge issue and dive in. And if the Olympics are an issue, great. And at the same time, don't forget the other stuff because the salmon don't have time. Are there sturgeon up there? There's sturgeon down here.
I think that's
And
it.
they don't have time either.
Okay, I'm gonna try and combine this one. It has to do with technology. As the oil companies decline, there's a new energy sector, solar power, wind power, that's coming up. And it's going to be big business and there's going to be a lot of money in it. Although there's some people saying that because there's the chance for lots of new startups, it could be an energy revolution and it could be local energy produced locally. I'm wondering whether you think solar panel technology is on our side or not. You're doing something there. And then.
The universal masturbation symbol. Well, no, universal male masturbation symbol. I should also be going like this or something. I don't know.
And the other bit of that is the role of advanced technology in post-civilization society. We've already got the towers up for the internet, which is potentially maybe not. What's your thoughts on the internet in post-civilization? Is it all gone, primitivist, or
All
is there
gone.
any role it can have? Okay.
No, because the person to read on all this is Richard Heinberg, that he and the party's over. And in Peak Everything, he talks about how there is nothing that can replace oil. And I mean, already there are various rare earths, I think, that are already becoming rare. There are already bottlenecks in producing solar panels. And a couple things. One is we have to remember that the military and corporations use the internet far more effectively than we could ever hope to. And much as I may love, playing poker on the internet, or internet, betting on, the fucking Yankees to lose, that doesn't alter the fact that those technologies allow members of the U.S. military to sit in Las Vegas or Florida and to kill people in Pakistan with Predator drones. And they allow accounting systems, and they allow the transfer of money, and they allow the movement of resources on scales that were unimaginable without computers. And computers are a net huge loss for the natural world. And as is, I mean, but here's the bottom line, is that any technologies that are not based on what the land gives willingly are not sustainable. Any technologies that are based on harming the land base are not sustainable. The only way you can live in place is to not hurt the land. That's how the Tala lived here for 12,500 years, is by not harming the land for that long. And that's how you survive, is actually by helping the land to become better in its own terms. That's how the land became so wonderfully wild and fecund in the first place, was that salmon make forests a better place by their simple existence, and redwood trees make salmon better because of their existence. And if the Tala were living here for 12,500 years, they were making the place better by their very existence, or they wouldn't have survived. And I mean, computers are extraordinarily toxic. And here's the thing, is that you can't take these technologies just independently. And you have to have, to have solar power, you have to have mining in order to have copper wiring. You can't have all these groovy wind power things, which are, of course, they kill bats on a massive scale, but you can't have windmills without mining also. And so you can't have just, as much as I love watching BBC Mysteries with my mom, or as much as I love a space heater for my toes, and as much as I love ice cream, you can't have those without all the other technologies. And there's one more concept I want to introduce, which is very, very important, which is, Lewis Mumford talked about something called a technics, TECHNICS. And what that is that's the combination. Technologies don't exist in a vacuum, that you have a whole technics, which is the social structure that leads to and emerges from a technology. And he talked about democratic and non-democratic technics. And there are democratic technics, would be technologies that are personal scale and are capable of being controlled at the personal scale. Pottery, for example. Anybody can make pottery. Arrowheads, fishing nets. Anybody could weave reeds into a basket. Basket weaving is a democratic technique, because you don't have to rely on Monsanto, or you don't have to rely on ADM or Cargill. And a non-democratic technique would be one that you cannot control in your community. Automobiles are non-democratic because I can't make one in my community. My neighborhood cannot make a car. You have to have an entire infrastructure, which means you have to have a whole non-democratic system, and you have to have this whole system of exploitation. So the question isn't whether we can save, because computers are inherently non-democratic, because me and my community cannot make them. Stone knives are democratic techniques, because I and my community could make them. So the only, and we can say the same thing really for sustainability, that the only sustainable techniques are democratic techniques, small scale community. And you can't have wind electricity generation on a communal scale, because you still need the mining in order to create, to get the metals. And for in the short term, sure, there can still be, through the crash, I wish I had solar panels on my house so I could keep my refrigerator running, after the crash finishes. But that's not sustainable in the long run. It's going to go down, and then it's going to eventually stay down. And I guess to end, I want to go back to the question that was asked of me in Portland when the woman said, who will stop this culture? Who will do what is necessary to protect the salmon, or do what is, oh, I want to say two things. One is that I did a talk in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and when I was there, I was doing a benefit for an organization that was trying to stop a distant corporation from putting a toxic waste dump in their impoverished community made up of people of color, Hispanic people, Mexican Americans. And the cops were consistently arresting them, and they were not arresting the representatives of the distant corporations who were poisoning the people. And I said, what would happen if the cops actually enforced laws that we already have? What would happen if cops enforced cancer-free zones? What would happen if cops enforced dam-free zones, clear-cut-free zones, Olympic-free zones? What if cops enforced rape-free zones? And of course, it's a joke because that's not the real role of cops. That, it's like a cop wrote to me one time, and he said he was reading Endgame and he really liked it. And but he said, one of the problems is that you seem to blame cops too much. And the cops, cops are just, our job is to protect people from sociopaths. And I wrote back to him, and I said, I agree that part of the role of police is to protect us from sociopaths. My problem is they only protect us from the poor sociopaths, like the kids who burglarized my house. They don't protect us from the rich sociopaths. And I got another question for you, which is, why is it that when people go on strike, the cops, whenever they're called in to break the strike, they always go after the strikers? Why did they go after the capitalists and force them to terms? And he never wrote me back. But the point is, what would happen, since the police are not going to enforce cancer-free zones or rape-free zones, what would happen if we enforce cancer-free zones ourselves? And what would happen if we enforce rape-free zones? Have you heard of the Gulabi Gang? They're great. It's also called the Pink Sari Gang. And it's a group of women in India, large group, who have taken, they train in martial arts, and they go through villages, and if they see a man beating up a woman, they beat the shit out of him. And that happened in Maoist China too after the revolution. The woman would go through villages, and if they saw a man beating up a woman, they would beat him. If they saw him doing it again, they'd kill him. Wife beating went down. Pretty straightforward. So what would happen if we in our communities began to enforce rape-free zones? What would happen if we in our communities began to enforce Olympic-free zones, or cancer-free zones, dam-free zones, clear-cut-free zones? Choose your poison. And so now I want to go back to, and I want to end with that question that woman asked about who is going to do this? Who is going to enforce a cancer-free zone? Who is going to enforce rape-free zones? Who is going to enforce fish farm-free zones? Who is going to enforce, no stolen land zones where the land goes back to the indigenous, the rightful owners? And so that's what I want to leave you with, is who's going to do it? Thanks.
Hey, Derek, thanks a lot, man.
Okay.
Have a great night.
Thanks. Yeah, and give lots of money to Frank.
All right. Thanks.
See you.
This presentation is brought to you by SubMedia. You can check us out online at submedia.tv.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. Here's Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock to introduce the final segment.
From the 2009 Gaining Ground Summit in Vancouver, British Columbia, you are about to hear Dr. Bill Rees, co-inventor of the Ecological Footprint. The meeting theme was Resilient Cities, Urban Strategies for Transition Times. On the topic, Planning Down, What If Can Do, Can't, Bill Rees is introduced by conference moderator Ron Abbott.
It is a pleasure now to introduce one of Canada's most eminent environmental scientists, as well as one of Canada's most effective teachers. For the past 40 years, Bill Rees has carved out a niche at the University of British Columbia within the School of Community and Regional Planning, and I think part of Bill's legacy is in this room this week, because so many of the planners who are working hard to reshape Vancouver and other cities learned their craft in part under Bill's guidance and tutelage. Bill is, of course, also the co-developer of the Ecological Footprint, and he has a penetrating mind, a rigorous commitment to research, and the ability, I think, better than most, to take that research and intellect and couple it to applied policy in a way that should light the way ahead for all of us. Please join me in welcoming Professor Bill Rees.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. I'm going to also thank Gene. I have a particular reason for doing this, and it is that he gave me this title. And I said, what can you do with a title like that? What if can do can't? So I thought about it for a while, and what you're about to hear is what I've attempted to do with that title. Rob mentioned that I am a scientist, and I will speak to you as a scientist, particularly as an ecologist, which frees me from the burden of having to be practical for the time being. So I'm not oriented to design, I'm not oriented to a city building per se, but what I want to do is to talk about the groundwork, and I want to start at the end of my presentation in case I never get there. These are the main takeaway points. And Nola Kate made some reference to this. The first point is that perception is everything. Our perceptions determine how we act out in the world. Cities are an emergent phenomena. They just don't happen. They come out of how we think about ourselves in relation to nature. So the structure and function of cities reflects how we think about that relationship. And unfortunately, our techno-industrial culture is a society of dualistic reductionism. We think of humans as separate from nature, reduce everything down to tiny parts, and we never seem to be able to assemble these in our minds as we go forward. So in this context, modern cities have emerged from our way of thinking on the landscape as fractured, incomplete human ecosystems. They parasitize the ecosphere in their present structure. For sustainability, if we're serious about this, cities must become much more self-reliant, much more self-producing, self-organizing. They must be much more complete as ecosystems. And I begin to think, when I hear these words, of something that I'm calling an eco-centered regional city-state. Provinces, by the way, have long since become obsolete for reasons I'll get to toward the end. There are two elements of context here. One is the science. By the way, I'm going to show no models, so those of you who are skeptical of models, everything on the board here is going to be real data. So these are real data about the human population explosion and the explosion of the human enterprise. I could have extended the x-axis into the next room for 50,000 or 100,000 or even a million years. It would have been just as flat as the 2,000 years I'm showing you. And what you have to take from this is that the past eight generations of humans live in a completely anomalous, abnormal period of human history, a period of growth. In fact, it's only been two generations of people since the 1950s in which economic growth or any form of growth has actually been an instrument of public policy. So what we take to be the norm is actually the single most abnormal phase in the history of our species. And if I were looking at any other species, I would call this the plague phase of the species, exploitation of its environment, which inevitably leads to implosion. I haven't got time to spend on the implosion part. The second part of context, again, goes back to the human mind. And it has to do with the psychology that Nola Kate talked about. I'm going to read the text and I'll explain it. And so while the end of the world scenario will be rife with unimaginable horrors, the pre-end period is full of opportunities for profit. And that's exactly how we're approaching this issue. We have an intellectual understanding of the nature of our dilemma, but our response to it is to green business, to develop all sorts of ways to make additional money, to grow in a somewhat different way when we think the way that we do. So the can-do vision that Jean challenged me with, I think, is incorporated in the notion that we can grow differently, using technology to move us forward in pretty much the same way as we have in the past, without any substantial changes in our way of doing business. So there's a problem, but our response springs from our belief in human ingenuity and the incredible capacity of people to deal with crisis. It's always worked in the past. It will continue to work in the future. And perhaps the most ebullient expression of this is from the late Professor Julian Simon, who wrote many books with titles like The Ultimate Resource, referring to the human mind. Technology exists now to produce in inexhaustible quantities all the products made by nature. We have the technology to feed, clothe, and supply energy to an ever-growing population for the next 7 billion years. That should stir you in your hearts, because this is the essence of true optimism. And by the way, it's also paralytic, because if you believe this, then there's no need to do anything at all. Well, I want to suggest that this attitude, this techno-fix approach, the can-do attitude, has led us astray. Most approaches to climate change, global change in general, such as renewable energy, hybrid cars, green buildings, smart growth, new urbanism, green consumerism, a very long list, are delusional. They do not take into account the science in any significantly important transformative way. They assume we can maintain growth through greater material and energy efficiency. It's really the status quo by other technological means. Now, here is really the key to what I'm getting at here. What the science says is that we need an absolute reduction in energy and material throughput in our economy of about 80% by mid-century to avoid catastrophic climate change. So you can accept it or not. It's probably safer to accept it if it's even marginally true. I'm going to assume it is true for the sake of argument. So the bottom line is that whatever you're doing, if we need that 80% of reduction, if your solution, if where you are working, does not result in an absolute reduction in energy and material use in your community, in your building, or whatever, then you're not on track. You're not part of the solution. You're really contributing more to the problem. So I want to give you a few examples of what I'm getting on here. This is a recent edition of the Ford Escape hybrid vehicle. Note that they appropriate one of our most powerful green cultural symbols, Hermit the Frog. That's a really authoritative figure. But the point is that we pander to the, we all want to be good, you know, I want to be nice, so I'm going to buy this car instead of another car like the Toyota Echo, for example, which gets 50 miles to the gallon, but it's not green because it's not a hybrid. So here we have the appropriation of a cultural symbol in the sale of more goods that are frankly not a particularly good example of anything. And again, as Richard Register said, it just perpetuates the illusion that cities ought to be built around automobiles. And this is actually a fairly benign example. Try this one. This is the Chevy. I just scanned these from some recent magazines. This is the Tahoe a hybrid. This vehicle weighs 7,300 pounds. That's 3.3 metric tons. But it's a hybrid. And because it's a hybrid, and by the way, it gets the lowest gas mileage of any hybrid vehicle on the planet, but it's a hybrid, and so it merits the Green Car of the Year Award for 2008. Now, again, people run out and buy this sort of thing because it makes them feel good about contributing to the planet. The only way to think about that is everybody drove one of these 7,300-pound or 3.3 metric ton vehicles, would the Earth be a healthier place? Which gets lousy gas mileage, by the way. How could it get good mass mileage? It weighs more than the average elephant. So we're in cities. We live in buildings. We're all moving to green buildings, green architecture, green housing. So between 1950 and 2004, the average new house in North America went from about 900 or 1,000 square feet up to about 2,300 square feet, an increase of 135% over a half-century period, during which the green rhetoric continually accelerated. Everything about them is bigger. We've gone from, you park your car in the lane to four-car garages now, not being uncommon in some of these homes. They all have industrial-scale appliances, 9-foot ceilings, and so on. Meanwhile, while the house size is more than doubling, we see a shrinkage of family size from 3.7 to 2.6 people. So that floor space per capita increases by 236% during the period of the loudest green rhetoric you can possibly imagine on the planet. But these houses, a tiny fraction of them, are about 25% more efficient per unit area as the 1950s house. So it's completely delusional to think we've made progress. These new large-scale so-called greenhouses haven't a fraction of the green associated with them as the primitive old 1950s 900 or 1,000 square foot houses. We're living in a complete fantasy land. And as I say, the way we think about things produces the products and the marketing and all the rest of it that is shaping the culture that is taking the planet down. Now, in that kind of context, cities could be resilient, but we've created them to be among the most vulnerable structures on the planet. I love this quote that I found. I don't even know where he said it, but Martin Oppenheimer, an American sociologist, today's city is the most vulnerable social structure ever conceived. They're threatened by peak oil, by soil losses, by climate change, by geopolitical instability. All of these things, of course, are tied together. I wish I had more time to explain to you why we're not even sensitive to this as yet, but I want to say that much of it has to do with the way we have conceived our cities. Cities are incomplete systems. They are not the human ecosystem. The idea of an eco-city in a way different from what I'm going to talk about doesn't make any real sense. So if you were to encapsulate Vancouver in a bell jar or New York or any modern city, it would suffocate and starve simultaneously because the productive zone producing everything needed to maintain or sustain the city is happening elsewhere. The city is the human equivalent of a livestock feedlot. It's where we gather large numbers of people, but the productive landscape sustaining it is, scattered all over the planet. Cities have become, by virtue of the way we think about ourselves as separate from nature, parasitic blobs on the landscape. Horrible language to use. Vancouver's a beautiful place to live, but it's by far from being sustainable. We've known about this, again, for decades, since the beginning of the environmental movement. Eugene Odom, one of the great American ecologists, defined cities as parasitic. They are planned and grow without any regard for the fact that they must process vast quantities of waste and consume huge quantities of resources. Now, there's another fundamental physical law called the second law of thermodynamics, which makes the second two of these statements absolutely true. We think of ourselves as producers. We want to increase the productivity of the economy, of labor economy, and all of that. But the simple biophysical reality is that every act of human production involves the consumption of a vastly larger quantity of energy and material. So all human economic production is mostly consumption. Cities produce the wealth of nations only by consuming a vast quantity of natural wealth produced elsewhere in the ecosphere far from the boundaries of the city themselves. And here's an example of the parasitic nature of the human ecosystem, or rather of our urban culture. This is from Edward Bertinsky's new book on oil. I was honored to have written an introductory chapter to this. When I saw this photograph, I was floored because it reminds me I used to work in the far north. stick your arm out the window and it'll be covered by 190 mosquitoes within 30 seconds. So these are mosquitoes, great mechanical mosquitoes, sucking the blood from the earth and pumping it down to the city to where it's consumed in making a whole lot of other nasty things. So if you want to kind of image what I'm talking about here, just think of a number of pristine ecosystems, natural forests, grasslands, marine estuaries, coral reefs, or whatever. Now contemplate forest clear cuts, eroding farmlands, depleted fisheries, and marine dead zones. The only thing connecting those two images is human economic activity, because that's the way we think. We're not part of nature, so it doesn't matter what we do out there, it won't affect us over here. Well, this is what's going on in northern Alberta. This used to be boreal forest. Again, a take from Bertinsky's latest book. It looks like an oil spill in your driveway, but in the middle there, I've pointed out a huge warehouse. This is tens of thousands of hectares of utterly desecrated landscape to feed the insatiable appetite of the Ford Escapes and Chevy Tahoes in the cities far away, where this kind of thing is out of sight and out of mind. How much of nature do we actually appropriate in that way? And this is what we've done in the development of my ecological footprint concept. It's simply a measure of the amount of productive landscape required by any population, an individual, a city, a nation, to produce what it consumes and to assimilate its wastes. You all have a footprint. And because there's a declining amount of productive biospace out there, your footprint is growing as the available supply is shrinking, and as populations increase, we're all competing with each other, whether you're conscious of it or not, for the available biospace. We compete very successfully because we have very high incomes, enabling us to buy in global markets everybody else's eco-footprints. So the average ecological requirements of a person in this room is somewhere on the order of 7 hectares, something like 17 or 20 acres in that range. The poorest of the poor live on a third of a hectare, just a little less than an acre. On Earth, there are 2 average hectares per capita. So each of us in this room requires 3 to 4 times an equitable share of the global biocapacity to sustain us in the style to which we are accustomed. And despite all of the greening of our economy, this number gets bigger year in and year out as our salaries increase and as technological gizmos fail because of something called the rebound effect. The principal biophysical impact of improvements in technological efficiency is to increase consumption. Counterintuitive, but there it is. Now, the problem is that many countries now, because their populations have such large footprints, live mostly on land and water productivity located outside of their own boundaries. Every country in Europe requires 2 or 3 times the size of its domestic biocapacity to sustain itself. What globalization does has enabled the wealthy countries to extend their footprints into the productive landscapes of other countries and into the global commons. Now, there's 2 evil effects of this. The first is it removes from consciousness our dependence on ecosystems, because we don't even see that we're dependent on our local ecosystems, because we're not. Secondly, since everybody's doing this, it's drawing down the natural capital assets and filling up the sinks all over the planet. So as we blissfully move forward in our consumer lifestyles, we're actually all rising simultaneously to a lowering global ceiling of the true limits to growth. So one planet living would be living within the productive capacity of Earth, and if we did that, we'd have to reduce our footprints to 2 hectares per capita from the current roughly 7, but we're not doing that. Population is increasing. Per capita consumption is increasing even faster, so there's an accelerating upslope in terms of overall demand. This is now in exceedance of carrying capacity, we estimate, by about 30% on a global basis, which means that we are beginning to deplete the natural capital, the productive fisheries, forests, soils that we need to sustain future consumption. Even as we're in this state of overshoot, the productivity of the landscape is declining, and hence we're eroding our future prospects.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. You are listening to Canadian scientist Dr. Bill Reese from the Gaining Ground Resilient Cities Conference in Vancouver, Canada, October 21st, 2009. The co-inventor of the eco-footprint, Bill Reese, is now warning that humans are consuming the planet to death.
Thinking of this in an urban context, now using our methods, a group under the direction of Dr. Carl Folke at Stockholm University examined the 29 largest cities in the Baltic states of Europe. That's around the Baltic Sea. So if we just average the total land area and population of those things and look at all the resource and energy flows and tie these back to the landscape, it turns out that every square kilometer, that's that little tiny square on the left-hand side, of urbanized land requires 18 square kilometers of forest in continuous production to provide the wood, fiber, and paper. 50 square kilometers of arable land per square kilometer of urbanized land to produce food for those people. These are big fish eaters, so it takes 130 square kilometers of the most productive marine environment for every square kilometer of those cities. The blocks on the right refer to the land requirements for the assimilation of the waste throughput. Everything that goes into an economy comes out as waste that must be assimilated. And there are two different sets of assumptions here. The black is a very conservative set. The other is a bit wangy. But the point is, somewhere between 600 and 1,100 square kilometers of productive biocapacity of landscape and waterscape is needed for every single square kilometer of urbanized land in the Baltic states. And this is typical of large, high-income countries in Europe, North America, and Japan. Now, any sensible urban ecosystem would include within its purview the productive landscape needed to sustain the consumptive activity going on in the city. And until we move toward thinking of the city as an entire self-producing, self-reliant urban ecosystem that incorporates these productive landscapes, we're going nowhere. Our current way of developing cities ensures that we continue to deplete the very regions that sustain us because we don't even know they exist. They become invisible because of the globalization phenomena. Think of a city like Tokyo, which is a monstrosity. It's a wonderful place in many social and artistic and cultural, technological ways, but it's not supportable. Tokyo has 33 million people, the same population as Canada. Tokyo requires, to sustain itself, an area that is 4.3 times the area of Japan and about 2.1 times the nation's domestic biocapacity. Japan is very productive, but the bottom line is that Japan could not support its capital city on the entire biocapacity available to it were it cut off from global trade by climate change, international geopolitics, which may go rangy when we start competing for energy and resources, and so on. This is an unsustainable entity. And many other cities on the planet are following this path because of the assumption we can always have access to these resources wherever they are on the planet, as we exist in complete ignorance of the fact that we're depleting it even as we talk about this. So there are three major vulnerabilities to cities. The first is the erosion of agricultural landscape. Most cities couldn't come close to sustaining themselves if every bit of green area were planted to vegetable gardens or fruit trees. We need a much larger area than that. And right now we're losing agricultural land at an accelerating rate. We've lost enough in the last 30 or 40 years to feed all of Europe, for example, and the pace is increasing. Well, we don't notice because oil, in the form of fertilizers, pesticides, mechanized agriculture, have maintained productivity and increased it in areas, even as other areas are being taken out of production. The problem is, and this is our second vulnerability, the phenomenon of peak oil. Most of the major oil fields on the planet were discovered in the early 1960s. That's when the peak of discovery occurred. In the early 1980s, 20 years later, we passed the point at which every year consumption increases more rapidly than new discovery. And we've reached the point then where most people now who study this carefully think we've plateaued and are about to begin a long descent. And I don't care what you think about solar energy, wind power, or any of the available alternatives right now. I'm the guy who said we don't have the technologies ready to go forward. In total, they do not begin to replace the energy demand of society that is currently satisfied by fossil fuel. which is a real problem, also because of the climate thing, which raises the third vulnerability of cities. The simple fact of the matter is that cities, our current agriculture, all of that depends on an extraordinarily stable period of climate during which the soils were formed and the agricultural development has occurred. If Canada warms up by 3 degrees and the agricultural climate moves north, it's going to move north into the tundra, the boreal forest. This is not good soil, and our best soils may not be capable of sustaining significant productivity. At any rate, carbon dioxide emissions, which are driving the human component of climate change, were by no means the major part of climate change, but were a major component at the margin. Carbon dioxide is the driver here, and carbon dioxide emissions are rising now much faster than the worst case scenario of the models. And I want to emphasize this. It's true that the climate change models are erroneous, but they're erroneous in the wrong direction. I could put up 100 slides to illustrate that. So we've seen increases since 2000, about 35% ahead of projections. This is what it looks like. Again, real data, not a model. This is from Mauna Loa Observatory in Hawaii. The instrumentation is sensitive enough to catch the breathing of the Earth. The sawtooth pattern is the summer and winter oscillations. In the summer, plants are sucking up the carbon dioxide. In the winter, it accumulates. But every winter, a little more accumulates than was taken up in the previous summer. And so we have a steady increase. And notice that the increase is increasing from 1.3 parts per million in 1970 to 79 to 2.3 parts. It's doubled. The rate of increase in CO2 emissions or accumulations is doubling. And it has a corresponding impact on climate. Again, it's a jagged picture, but the trend is clear and upward. And notice in particular that between 1940 and 1980, it was actually seemingly cooling. So the fact that we're in a 2 or 3 year cooling period right now, not cooling, just slower rates of warming, doesn't mean it's over. It means that the climate is very erratic, and it will start ticking up again when certain circumstances, I haven't got time to describe to you, take hold. Now, here's the real kicker. The most recent studies, and this was just reaffirmed this week by the Hadley Center in the UK, suggest that we are going to have one hell of a time restraining carbon dioxide emissions below 650 parts per million. Note here that we're already approaching 400 parts per million. The safe level over on the far left is 300 parts per million. And now we're seeing signs that because of the unanticipated uptick in this, that we're unlikely to reconcile below 650 parts per million. 650 parts per million means about a 50% chance of a 4 degree or greater global warming. Now, that is an astronomical change in global climate. In order to avoid this, we need to begin reducing our emissions. Remember I said the only thing that counts is an absolute reduction by about 6% per year and accelerating thereafter in the OECD countries. No country on Earth is coming close to policy that would even remotely approach this kind of target. So again, if the science is correct, we are condemning ourselves to a 4 degree world. And this is what a 4 degree world looks like. I mean, 4 degree warmer in mean global temperature. All of the yellow and brown areas are essentially uninhabitable landscape. And you'll notice that includes India, China, most of Africa, that's about 3 billion people right there, a good part of South America, and about half the United States. The only places that come out ahead in terms of temperature, at any rate, are Canada and Russia, and they will be asked to accommodate the 3 billion other people who can no longer live in their territory. So this is not just dicking around. You know, we're in a bliss bubble if you think that, you know, green lead whatever is going to make any difference at all. It's just growing us more efficiently. And there's no particular virtue in becoming more efficiently unsustainable. That's what this message is all about. So get ready for it, because we've had a shipload of people land on the coast here. That's just a little preview of what might be happening in 50 years when hundreds of millions of people are displaced from coastal communities, from agricultural lands that are abandoned because there's no water or the soil has otherwise been depleted, and so on. There are dozens of studies you never read about in the news that talk about these consequences. Here are quotes from two of them. The Age of Consequences, we predict an inevitable scenario in which people and nations are threatened by, etc. I won't read these, but the point is, why aren't we paying attention? These are high-powered, high-paid studies of the social consequences of global change. What we mean, or what this all boils down to, and again, keep in mind, I'm assuming the science is right, I'm assuming we want to survive. The only thing we need to think about is how do we reduce our absolute contribution drivers here. And again, it goes way back to an International Business Council on Sustainable Development meeting in Antwerp in 1993 that said, look, the data suggest, even then, that it's a 90% reduction in energy and material throughput in rich countries, because in order to create the ecological space, in my terminology, the eco-footprints of the rich countries have already appropriated most of the biocapacity of the planet to make room for those. The UN last week announced that officially now 1 billion people are in starvation, badly malnourished. That's the largest number ever in the history of the planet, and more people who were alive than were alive when Malthus wrote his original essay. That's the situation we're facing. And we aren't conscious of it because it's over there somewhere. But they say a 90% reduction. Our ecological footprint work says that if we're going to have sustainability with equity on a single planet that is shrinking, then we in North America should be working now to devise the social safety nets, the structural changes necessary to bring our per capita eco footprints down from an average of 9 in North America to about 2 per capita. Now, cities have a huge leg up in doing this. I'm a great fan of density. I was somewhat behind the eco-density movement in Vancouver here, advising the mayor with a group of my students on how we might conceive of that. I know some of you have difficulty with the equity aspects of it, but that can be taken care of. The point is, there's all kinds of economies of scale and agglomeration economies that emerge from higher density. These slides are freely available to anyone who wants them, so I'm not going to read this. But we need to go further. Efficiency is not enough. All the eco-density stuff is efficiency-oriented. We really need to rethink the city as the human ecosystem. We need to reconceive them and redesign them to incorporate as much of their supportive ecosystems within their own political jurisdictions as is possible. If you know that you are dependent on that acre, you will not permit unwarranted greenfield development on that acre. We are paving over the Fraser Valley despite the land reserves because we assume we can always import our food from elsewhere. The elsewhere is mostly California, which if you speak to people from California are now saying, we may not have any agriculture in 50 years at the rate the water is drying up. They've had to shut down tens of thousands of hectares this year because there is no water. We have a very, very limited view of our own sustainability if we continue to think we can continue to, in a sec, parasitize other places simply because we have the money to do so. So we have conceptual models, bioregionalism, learning to live more or less off the land base in your region, permaculture, which would double the productivity of our land base without having to resort to chemical pesticides and fertilizers and all of that sort of thing. So I'm thinking we really have to think 50 years ahead in terms of reconceiving the city as an urban-centered eco-city state. The provinces are obsolete. The Canadian Constitution makes no reference to communities, to cities. It's provinces in the federal government. But most of us now live in cities. Why not reorganize our settlements so that they are in charge of a significant resource base in their vicinity? Wouldn't work for a place like Tokyo. Tokyo needs other kinds of arrangements. But Canada, parts of the United States are capable of thinking this way. This is really going outside of the box so that we can claim this urban system as a complete self-referencing, self-producing, self-sustaining, self-supporting entity that is not dependent so much on other places. It doesn't mean no trade, because if we have a network of these kinds of interdependent regions, they can exchange, but they exchange in terms of true ecological surpluses. And that's where we should be going. And it's actually an old idea, going back to some of the great planners, Patrick Geddes, Lewis Mumford, Ebenezer Howard, and so on. Now, a lot of people say, God, that bugger's, you know, depressing. And listen, this is the good news, and I just want to take you through it. I'm saying the science looks good to me because it's just unfolding exactly as we've said it would all along. So if we stay the course, in other words, business as usual, we're going to get accelerated resource depletion, accelerating global change, climate chaos, greater systemic pollution, economic uncertainty. Hey, we've had a lot of great economic stuff, coming out of the mainstream recently. A widening income gap, which is steadily happening all over the planet, including in our own country. Increasing civil unrest, potential geopolitical chaos, and possible cultural collapse. Now, there's a really neat scenario for you, and it comes right out of doing nothing, which is what most of our politicians would like to have us do. On the other hand, if we take seriously the science and move toward an eco-transformation of sorts, we might get conservation and restoration of the essential natural capital we need to sustain ourselves, agricultural soils, forests, water supplies, and so on and so forth. We would have cleaner air, soil, and water. We would have a higher degree of economic security because we would plan social safety nets so that people who are being displaced from sunset industries into more sustainable forms of development have that transition support from the rest of the community. We need to recreate community is a message that's coming across here, which means narrowing the income gap. We need greater social capital and sense of community, greater political or geopolitical stability. See, down this path on the left, we're going to be at war within 40 years over the declining resource base. It's already beginning to appear in such things as Iraq and Afghanistan and so on. So we need to move towards the right because the pressures are real and we'll be better off for it. So again, this is the good news story. The political conundrum is the following. We can't muster the will to move toward eco-transformation. And it has to do with cognitive dissonance, something else that Nola Kate mentioned. Human beings evolved such that as a person develops individually in a society, we take on the baggage of that society, the political ideologies, the ways of thinking, you know, the Cartesian dualism I spoke about at the middle. And it actually helps to shape synaptic circuitry in the brain. And once that's in place, it's very difficult to shift out of it. Nola Kate mentioned, we don't like change. Well, this is why we don't like change. It's, in a sense, hardwired by your individual development. And once it's hardwired, we seek out experiences that reinforce what we already think. That's why most of you are in this room, by the way. And we avoid, deny, or otherwise denigrate anything we don't want to hear about. And that's how we act. So we're always resistant to change because if it worked for my grandfather, it worked for me. And by the way, that was an adaptive strategy 3,000 years ago. If you survived in a tribal circumstance, it's because they were doing something right. Better to take on that burden. But now it doesn't work because the very circumstances that we have created comes from thinking that is destructive. And if we take on that thinking, we'll just carry on down this path. We really need to shift. The problem is, what's ecologically necessary is politically unfeasible, but what's politically feasible, look at what we're doing in this country. We don't even have a climate policy, is ecologically irrelevant and will get us nowhere. So be the change, as someone has already said. And by the way, good luck. Thanks very much.
You have just heard a keynote presentation from the 2009 Gaining Ground Summit in Vancouver, British Columbia, held October 20th to 22nd. That was Dr. Bill Reese, co-inventor of the Ecological Footprint. The meeting theme was Resilient Cities, Urban Strategies for Transition Times. Bill Reese spoke on Planning Down, What If Can Do Can't. This recording is by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Find this and other speeches as free MP3 downloads in the Cities section of our audio on-demand menu at ecoshock.org. For more information and video of the Resilient Cities Conference, go to www.gainingground-summit.com.
Thank you for listening to another edition of Unwelcome Guests. And to Frank Lopez of Submedia TV and Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock for their recordings. You can download a copy of this program at unwelcomeguests.org.